Welcome to this Forthright Radio for July 5th, 2017. I'm Joy LaClaire. We have a very full show for you today in two segments. Quote, for Indians, defeat in the face of American progress and manifest destiny was supposed to be a foregone conclusion, end quote. So writes our guest in the first half of today's broadcast, Julian Brave Noisecat, in his article, When the Indians Defeat the Cowboys, published in the January 2017 issue of Jacobin magazine. We'll be hearing from this young indigenous scholar, journalist, and activist in the first half of our show. Then, in the second half hour, we'll be speaking with Doug Peacock, Montana grizzly bear aficionado, who, among many, many other things, was an erstwhile friend of Edward Abbey and inspiration for the character George Washington Hayduke in Abbey's seminal work, The Monkey Wrench Gang. We'll be speaking with him about the delisting of grizzlies from the endangered species list, as well as what the heck is going on with Montana's Washington gang now that two-thirds of its congressional delegation, excluding the other third, organic farmer Senator John Tester, are not only from the same small city of Bozeman, Montana, who work together at the same cyber technology startup, Right Now Technology, but both became multimillionaires after Oracle bought it for $1.5 billion. You may remember hearing about the recently elected Greg Gianforte, who pled guilty to assaulting Guardian journalist Ben Jacobs the night before the statewide special election to replace former Representative Ryan Zinke, who had been confirmed as Secretary of Interior. Well, we hope you can stay tuned for that. But first, we hear an interview recorded July 4th with self-described indigenous writer, wonk, and activist, Julian Brave Noisecat. Julian Brave Noisecat graduated Phi Beta Kappa and magna cum laude in history from Columbia University in 2015. The next year, he received a master's in global and imperial history from Oxford University, which had awarded him a Clarendon scholarship. His writings have appeared in The Guardian, Jacobin, Fusion, Salon, High Country News, as well as others. He is a member of the Kanem Lake Band Teskasen tribe within the province of British Columbia. Here is our conversation with Julian Brave Noisecat. A week ago, on June 28th, you published an article in The Guardian titled, Surveillance at Standing Rock Exposes Heavy-Handed Policing of Native Lands. Listeners may already be aware of the exposés published by The Intercept and discussed on Democracy Now! Very briefly, please talk about the corporation Tiger Swan and its surveillance activities at the Standing Rock resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline. But the heart of this question is actually to explore the history of Indigenous peoples being policed and dealt with via the criminal justice system rather than as sovereign peoples whose resistance is more appropriately taken as exercising their sovereign rights. Go into that history from President Andrew Jackson, whom our 45th president says he emulates, on to the Fourth Laramie Treaties of 1851 and 1868 to, and I'm quoting your article here, President Abraham Lincoln, who ordered the hanging of 38 Dakota warriors by reframing them as criminals guilty of murder and robbery instead of enemy combatants, who could not be executed according to international law even then. The execution of those warriors remains the largest mass execution in U.S. history, end of quote. And then, on to the suit brought by the Sioux Nation in 1978, claiming a violation of the Fifth Amendment vis-a-vis just compensation and what happened as a result. So that was a very long-winded question. I'll be happy to break it down for you, but do what you can with it.
Yes, I was among the many Americans who read the Intercept Tiger Swan documents, which detail Tiger Swan, which was a subsidiary held on retainer. They're a private security international mercenary firm held on retainer by Energy Transfer Partners, which was the parent company of the Dakota Access Pipeline. They're actually still employed by them. And The Intercept did an incredible investigation where they got these leaked Tiger Swan documents and did a big series on Tiger Swan's involvement in repression of the Dakota Access movement and then their movement on to other anti-pipeline movements and their surveillance and repression of those movements, some of which is a very vague legality. And I believe that the latest news is last week they were sued by, I don't want to say exactly remember, but they are now under greater legal scrutiny. Like many Americans, you know, I would be very wary of the use of, you know, someone basically a paid thug to being used to, you know, repress a democratic movement. But on native lands, you have to actually dig a little bit further and deeper than just the sort of top line narrative that you kind of glean from the Intercept reporting. And look specifically at the relationship between indigenous nations and the United States, which is a relationship rooted on hundreds of years of contests over sovereign authority, over lands, resources, and people, and access to lands, resources, and territories. And I think that's really the nut of the issue that gets obscured and overlooked far too often. I think people see native people and they sort of categorize them in with the rest of, you know, sort of multicultural America and issues of racism. But on this land in the United States, which belonged to our First Nations for thousands of years, there's a much more specific relationship. And that relationship is of one government to another government, of one nation to another nation, established in treaties. So this isn't just something that we yell about or insist upon without any legal basis, but it is something that was actually acknowledged through treaties, through other nation-to-nation agreements that were made between both the British Crown before and the United States government after. And that history has a particularly strong bite in the Standing Rock community in the area that is now known as North and South Dakota and Minnesota. In the 19th century, some of the most intense and brutal wars over land, resources, and sovereignty and sovereign control over area were waged between the Ocheti Shakowin or Great Sioux Nation and the United States government in that area. In 1862, there was an uprising of Dakota in what is now the state of Minnesota over the payment of annuities or the payment of food and other resources for their land. They went to war because they had surrendered their land through treaty and they were not receiving that payment. After months of warfare, their uprising was quelled and 38 of their number were actually executed by President Lincoln, which by international law at the time, as today, was actually illegal. You couldn't execute enemy combatants. But because these were Native people who couldn't be viewed as combatants of another sovereign order, who could only be viewed as criminals, they were able to be executed for crimes like murder and robbery and other things like that. So this has a really deep history, and it goes on into the 20th century. In 1978, the Sioux Nation sued the United States government for the unjust forfeiture, the taking without compensation of their lands in violation of the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. The court actually ruled in their favor, and in a pretty telling quote, the majority opinion said that there is no, I'm butchering the quote a little bit here, but basically that there was no greater instance of unjust dealings that the United States had engaged in. Because of the nature of the claim, which was rooted in compensation, they were not given return of their lands, which would have actually included the land that the Dakota Access Pipeline crossed over in North Dakota. That was treaty land as well. Instead, they were given what at the time was $100 million compensation, and they have to this day refused the payment. It is accrued interest and would be worth more than $1 billion. And these are some of the poorest people in the country in Standing Rock. They live in, 40% of the population lives below the poverty line, which is like three times the national average. So these are very, very impoverished people, but very defiant people who retain a commitment to their sovereign authority and control over resources and territory. And that's what was at the heart of the fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline. Who gets to say where this pipe and the, accompanying risks to water, to land, to people, to culture, et cetera, where does that go? And it seems clear in retrospect that despite, numerous treaties and agreements and despite an ongoing assertion of sovereignty, that Native people do not get to control and have a say over where these projects go, despite the fact that they're the ones who will have to live with the greatest risk.
And to amplify the concept that this is more properly considered warriors versus criminals, we are pre-recording this interview on the 4th of July, 2017, and that's the remembrance of the day that the Declaration of Independence signed. And this is a clause of that document in which the crimes of George III, King George III, are being enumerated. And here is one of the last ones. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Now, leaving aside the history that preceded that, in which the colonials had been savage in their warfare, my point in quoting that document is it talks about warfare, not crimes. So anyway, I'm very glad that you brought that to our attention. I don't think I was aware of it in quite the same way before I read your article. Among the many things you have written, there seems to be a theme, and that is that the movement of indigenous peoples is actually a global movement at this time. Could you expand upon that? And since we're anniversaries, and since Canada just celebrated their sesquicentennial, begin by focusing on the indigenous movements in Canada, and in particular, the premiers Trudeau's promises and how those are playing out.
So I'm actually a member of the Sequetmoc Nation, which is a First Nation in British Columbia, Canada. I have dual citizenship, and I pay very close attention, obviously, to what's happening in Canadian politics, and particularly in Aboriginal politics and policy. Trudeau, interestingly, obviously he came, if you're unaware of sort of Canadian politics, he came on the ouster of former Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who was the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party and was sort of viewed as a sort of George Bush type figure. So he came out of Alberta, which is essentially the Texas of Canada, a province built on oil wealth, and had sort of a vision for transforming Canada into a much more conservative, oil-driven economy, which there are still repercussions sort of reverberating from his policy decisions. Notably, I think First Nations were actually one of the first, probably the first group in Canada to really go out on an all-out offensive against the Harper government. In 2012, late 2012, they launched the Idle No More movement, which was a grassroots, pan-Indigenous, cross-country movement against the Harper government's bill C-45, which promised to remove a number of waterways and areas that were important to indigenous nations from protection in order to sort of ease the passage for pipelines and other extractive projects in Canada. And they came out very hard against this bill, and in many ways actually sort of began a groundswell of opposition to the Harper government that in many ways sort of cleared the path for Trudeau. And if you know anything about Canadian politics, Justin Trudeau, I mean, we see him down here. If you're, you know, progressive-minded person, he's kind of a often memed individual. You know, he's kind of like a Ryan Gosling meme of politics. You know, he's like this handsome, sexy guy who claims to be feminist and, you know, is fairly progressive, especially if you look out on the global political landscape right now, fairly progressive guy. In Canada, he would be about the equivalent of a Kennedy. So his father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, is undoubtedly the most prominent political leader of Canada's 20th century. He was the leader of the Liberal Party for close to 20 years, was prime minister for a very, very long time. And that's Trudeau's father, actually. And I think that First Nations still stand in opposition to many of his decisions, despite, you know, talking a big game on sustainability and becoming a more green country. He is very much in league with Trump on getting a lot of these transnational, transcontinental pipelines through. He has made a lot of promises on Aboriginal policy with regards to looking into the problem of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada, which is an issue of Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people being found, you know, going missing or being found dead, and the government doesn't really do particularly much to look into it. It's a big phenomenon in Canada. And has also made a number of promises with regards to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and other sort of landmark decisions that he has yet to uphold. The line on him is that he seems to be out there for the photo op and for the quote much more than he is for the actual progressive action. There's a lot happening in Canada in regards to sort of pushing him to follow through on his proposals and also pushing past those proposals towards a true nation-to-nation relationship between Indigenous peoples and the Crown in Canada.
It seems to me, if I remember correctly, that rather early on in his regime, he gave the go-ahead for, is it the Enbridge, the Kinder Morgan pipeline, right?
Yep.
Remind us about that and where that is. The First Nations immediately responded. Explain how they have responded and where it stands now and what's at stake.
So I believe you're talking about the Trans Mountain. Kinder Morgan has a number of pipelines, but I think you're referring to the Trans Mountain pipeline, which comes across British Columbia. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
For about a year now, there has been a lot of buzz and energy around the opposition to the Trans Mountain pipeline, which is a Kinder Morgan project that will cut across from the tar sands, northern Alberta, down through to the ports in the Vancouver area in British Columbia, which will cross a number of First Nations territories. And many Indigenous nations have been opposed to this project. And it was for a while being referred to because it was kind of coming a little bit delayed after the Dakota Access, the anti-Dakota Access movement. It was being referred to as sort of a Standing Rock North. And there was a big union of British Columbia Indian chiefs and a number of First Nations up there. There was a big movement opposed to it, and they've actually gained a lot more traction in Canada to oppose it. So alongside them, there are many Vancouverites and other people in British Columbia who are opposed. And actually, the latest development, which is very encouraging, is that for the first time in 16 years, the Liberal Party of British Columbia was unseated by a Green New Democratic Party. The NDP is the left party in Canada. Alliance, which has promised to stop the Trans Mountain pipeline, which there's some question as to how effectively they can do that, but they're going to do their best to stop it, and also to uphold the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the landmark decision in the Chilcotin Nation case, which was a big Supreme Court case that was settled in Canada in 2014, which essentially said that the Chilcotin Nation had that they needed consent from the Chilcotin Nation before they could put mining projects and other things into their territory. It's a very exciting time, I would say, in British Columbia politics. I think if there's anywhere on the continent where you will be able to see what a more just future looks like for not just First Nations, but all the people who share the land with them, I think it's being forged right now in British Columbia. So we should all be paying attention.
It's a very shaky present tense because it's a coalition and it only has one vote holding it in power. Is that true?
Yeah, it was essentially the way they were able to take power was because the Greens became the swing vote. So the Greens, I believe, have three seats in British Columbia, and they were able to make a deal with the NDP to unseat the Liberals by I think you're right, I think it's one vote. So it is a very tenuous coalition, and the Liberals have been the traditional ruling party in British Columbia for quite some time. So they definitely have, I'm not going to paint a very rosy picture. It's not like they have an enormous mandate to go out there and stop pipelines and build a much more just and fair economy tomorrow. It's going to be much more complicated than that for the people who are in power. But I think it is encouraging for First Nations who have been, pushing for these issues for decades. I think they are seeing, the beginning of the light in some ways at the end of the tunnel.
What connects these two things, the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Trans Mountain Pipeline, is they're all infrastructure, billions and billions and billions of dollars worth of infrastructure to transport one of the poorest quality fossil fuels, with the possible exception of soft coal, and that is the tar sands of Alberta. And so there's a level at which someone who's not invested financially into those tar sands can legitimately consider this kind of insane. And it brings the question together, why are so many individuals, among whom President Trump was one, as well as banks, are investing in these things? Do you have anything to share with that about that?
Yeah, I mean, you could use a lot of fancy financial words to describe these pipelines. Some have described them as stranded assets, which is to say that people are putting in the pipelines where there might not actually be enough oil to support all the infrastructure that's building them. So the idea with stranded asset is you build it and then it doesn't end up actually being worth what you paid to build it. So that's the line that's coming from Mark Carnes, and so who's the chief of the Bank of England, and the Sightline Institute, which is based up in Seattle. There's a big question as to whether or not there's actually enough oil in the tar sands and Bakken to support all the projects that they're building. And you also have to wonder if people really know what they're buying here. It's, as you say, the shale, the Bakken shale oil, and the shale oil from the tar sands is not good quality oil. It's not this, it takes a lot to process. It's a lot more risky to bring to market, which is a big reason why they want to build these pipelines. It costs more to refine. In order for it, the basic math is that in order for it to be competitive with the OPEC-dominated market, which is, coming primarily out of Venezuela, the Middle East, et cetera, oil has to be well over $40 a barrel. And it's gotten over that in the last year or so, but it's not high enough over it that these guys can really be making the kind of money that they want to make. And so you have to wonder what the heck they're thinking. Why are they putting all their money in oil futures? Is it simply because these are, Dallas and Calgary oil men who don't really know how to do anything else but oil? This is their only dance move? Or do they really think that with Trump on their side now, they can push these things forward and make them profitable? Or do they simply not care? Is there some sort of scheme in which capital is put into here where they can take it out in a certain number of years, and at the end of the day, whether or not all the oil is there won't make a huge difference for some of the investors? I mean, you have to wonder about the whole structure of all these things and what is really pushing them to do it. Because in the big picture, the biggest picture, as in the picture of the future of the planet, it makes no sense. And even from the perspective of someone who wants to make a sound long-term business investment, it does raise some big question marks as to what people are actually buying, what people are actually putting their money into here.
I was intrigued by an article that you had published in Fusion on June 1st titled Line 3, Next DAPL. And you reported that oil was scheduled to begin flowing through the Dakota Access Pipeline that day, so that was June 1st, and that, quote, some might think June 1st marks a final nail in the coffin of the anti-Dakota Access movement that began on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in 2016 and spread around the world, but the global indigenous-led movement to protect water and land is just getting started. And that's the end of the quote. What is Line 3, and what do you mean about global indigenous-led movement to protect water and land is just getting started?
So Line 3 is another Canadian-originated pipeline that's going to cut across the state of Minnesota, which is where it will face the greatest opposition from both environmental interest groups, landowners, and Native nations in the state of Minnesota. It's actually opened for public comment right now, so if you happen to be Minnesotan who cares about these things, you should make sure your public thoughts about it are registered. It's essentially replacing a proposed pipeline that was called the Sandpiper Pipeline, which came through. See, I wrote about that pipeline in 2015. So it's essentially the line on it is that they took Sandpiper and they slapped Line 3 across the title, and then they put that back up for proposal. The Sandpiper Pipeline was actually effectively stopped by Native nations in Minnesota, et cetera. There's hope that this one can be stopped as well. And in Minnesota, they have a more rigorous environmental assessment process, so there's hope there. And I think that there's a number of Native nations in the path. The thing that I should really bring up is that the pipeline has already been assessed, and there are significant passages of the, you know, it's a multi-thousand page document that say that there are significant cultural and indigenous rights risks to the nations, regardless of the number of options of routes that they've sort of plugged in for Minnesota. They say that all of them, in different ways, pose threats to the treaty rights of the Ojibwe peoples who are in Minnesota. There's a big fight brewing there in Minnesota, especially with this current administration in, but there is a lot of hope that this one can be stopped. And then referring to the global indigenous movement, I think that we've touched now on the effectiveness and the sort of groundswell of political action of Native people in both the United States and Canada. But if you look beyond to other English-speaking nations with very similar histories of colonization, like Australia and New Zealand, and even beyond to Latin America, Amazon, et cetera, I think that it's pretty clear that there's a big sort of global indigenous movement that is moving from indigenous communities and is actually impacting now decisions in capitals, in places like New York and Toronto and London, et cetera. In Australia, for example, just this week, actually, the Aboriginal Australians and Torres Strait Islanders put on Prime Minister Turnbull's desk their sort of list of demands coming out of a national constitutional convention in Uluru in Australia. So they basically put a blueprint for what they want the constitutional relationship to be between First Nations in Australia and the Australian government, which is an enormous historical moment that happened just this past week. And in New Zealand, you have, you know, constant, it seemed the most sort of progressive of this group of countries that we're talking about. You have constant sort of fights between the Crown and the Maori over what the exact relationship will be, hinging upon what's called the Treaty of Waitangi down there, which is the sort of founding document of the nation in many ways. It was a treaty struck between the Maori and the Pakeha, or English colonists, over their relationship on the land. And so there's constant settlements and legal battles over what that relationship will look like in law and in practice. And so I think, you know, if you look all over the world, there's lots of encouraging signs that this world that you look out upon, it was very much built in opposition of indigenous peoples over our societies and cultures. But it might not be that way in the 21st century, which I find to be incredibly, incredibly hopeful.
Julian Grave Noisecat, you're doing a great job keeping us informed about the global Indigenous movement. And boy, there is so much to learn about and from it. But since we're out of time, I can't let you go without asking you about your question. Why can't we elect a Native American like Faith Spotted Eagle as president? She's a wise woman and leader who stood with and for her people. Why can't she be the president of the United States? So my question is, who is Faith Spotted Eagle and how did she get a vote in the Electoral College of 2016?
Faith Spotted Eagle is an awesome organizer and elder in the broader Native community. There was a Native delegate who in the Electoral College who gave his vote to Faith Spotted Eagle in protest after the 2016 election. It was entirely symbolic, but it was encouraging. I think that it was a big deal that a Native person would have enough visibility, or that someone would think well enough of them to throw even a protest vote in their direction.
Well, thank you for joining us today on Forthright Radio, Julian Brave Noisecat. We very much appreciate your work.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great.
So that was Julian Brave Noisecat. You're listening to Forthright Radio, and I'm your host, Joy LeClaire. As I mentioned at the top of the hour, our guest in our second segment is Doug Peacock, Montana grizzly bear aficionado who, among many, many other things, was an erstwhile friend of Edward Abbey and inspiration for the character George Washington Hayduke in Abbey's seminal work, The Monkey Wrench Gang. We'll be speaking with him about the delisting of the grizzly from the endangered species list, as well as what the heck is going on with Montana's Washington gang now that two-thirds of the congressional delegation, excluding the other third, organic farmer Senator John Tester, are not only from the same small city of Bozeman, Montana, who work together at the same cyber technology startup, Right Now Technology, but both became multimillionaires after Oracle bought it for $1.5 billion. You may remember hearing about the recently elected representative, Greg Gianforte, who pleaded guilty to assaulting Guardian journalist Ben Jacobs the night before the statewide special election to replace Representative Ryan Zinke, who had been confirmed as Secretary of the Interior. Doug Peacock was our guest on Forthright Radio in January 2014 after his book, In the Shadow of the Sabretooth, a renegade naturalist considers global warming, the first Americans, and the terrible beasts of the Pleistocene was published. After two tours as a special forces medic in the Central Highlands of Vietnam, Doug Peacock returned to the United States suffering from the not yet named post-traumatic stress disorder. He found wilderness was the only place he could be to deal with the effects of war trauma. And thus began his more than four decades of interacting with grizzlies, whom he credits with restoring his soul, and his dedication to protecting and preserving them and the wilderness they and we need to thrive. Doug Peacock was the subject of an award-winning film about grizzly bears in Vietnam called Peacock's War. Among his books are Walking It Off, A Veteran's Chronicle of War and Wilderness, Grizzly Years, In Search of American Wilderness, and In the Presence of Grizzlies, The Ancient Bond Between Men and Bears, written with his wife, Andrea Peacock. Doug Peacock, welcome back to Forthright Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, Joy. Thank you.
Well, Doug, it occurs to me that there was a connection I didn't realize when we scheduled this between the guests we had in the first half about the global Indigenous revolution and your work with Vital Ground and Round River Conservation Studies, which you co-founded. Just very briefly, talk about Round River Conservation Studies and Vital Ground, and then we'll get on to the things I've promised.
Vital Ground buys up private property as critical habitat for grizzlies. They've been doing that. We've been at it over 30 years now. Round River Conservation Studies is a little different kind of an outfit. I co-founded that back in the early 90s, and it is a student-based field program that works with indigenous peoples all over the world to create or protect native homelands. And to that end, Round River has protected over 30 million acres of wilderness. That's like 15 Yellowstone parks or so. So it's a lot of land. And it's working with people in British Columbia, like the Halisook, the Taku River Tlingit, where there's 10 million acres of wilderness as a final negotiation nation-to-nation with the province of British Columbia. We're currently up on the Beaufort Sea on the north slope of the Yukon with the Inuit people working this. Create a national park up there. But, you know, the fact that the Native Americans, the tribes, international tribal entities have come together to oppose the delisting of the Yellowstone Grizzly, to keep the Yellowstone Grizzly under federal protection. And our effort, it's all the same. You know, we're deeply, deeply spiritual about our investment with a grizzly bear. And that's an argument that the tribes have made better than anybody in the world, how important this mythical animal is to our very psyche. So it's a great alliance.
I am so encouraged to hear about that. So often we just bring out heartbreaking stories, and it's really wonderful to have something that's heartwarming. And especially when there is such tension around the ideas of religious rights. Well, it remains to be seen whose rights are actually going to be honored and how. Let's get back to the delisting of the grizzly bears from their former endangered species protections. Tell us exactly what is happening now.
We're talking about Yellowstone's grizzlies. Now, Yellowstone is an island of grizzly bears, 600-700. We don't really know exactly how many. But it doesn't matter. There's not very many, and they live in an island, and they don't migrate or exchange genetically or physically with populations up in Glacier Park, for instance. So the grizzly bear was put on the endangered species list. You know, I got started really early in the game. The same year that I embarked on a full-time film project filming wild grizzlies south of Canada, the grizzly bear was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in 1975. And it's been on that list for 42 years, and only in this last 2 weeks has that protection been lifted. What has been proposed is that after steady protection, no hunting, all kinds of rules that protected Yellowstone's grizzly bears, they're going to be trophy hunted immediately. All the federal protections are now dropped, and this is still in the process. It will be like 60 days before, you know, the actual Federal Register rule comes into effect. They're going to be turned over to the states for management, the states of Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho. Their idea of management is encased in a single phrase, trophy grizzly bear hunting. They're going to open a trophy grizzly hunt. And we believe that there's a lot of natural mortality in Yellowstone. That's really, I mean, it's not all natural. It's hunters mistaking grizzly bears for black bears, from feeling threatened by grizzly bears. Grizzly bears get hit on roads. So, you know, there's a lot of dead grizzly. Some people think it's about 80 a year. And once you start hunting them, that mortality will surge. And there's no way the states can turn, you know, the effects of a hunting season off fast. It's just not going to happen. There's no governor on this hunt. So we think the mortality is going to reach into the hundreds in a single year. And the grizzly bear, along with the muskox, is the lowest reproducing land mammal in North America. It just doesn't replace itself for half a dozen years or more. Every female bear, that is. And so deaths greatly exceed births. And there's no recruitment from the north because it's an island ecosystem. And it doesn't take a weatherman to figure out those odds. You know, that's extinction, or the hammering of the mortality hammering of the population down, where biologists don't think they can survive, and that'll happen faster than I want to guess, very fast, years, not decades.
Now, it's my understanding that this process actually began during the Obama administration. Is that so?
Yes. I spent the last year and a half pretty much fighting this single issue. But actually, the rumblings about delisting the grizzlies by the Federal Wildlife Service, and there is a distinct entity, a committee, it's the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee, that's in charge of the grizzlies south of Canada. And that is a, you know, that of course is the Federal Wildlife Service. And they started wanting to delist the grizzly back in the 90s, actually, talking about it at least, because it would signal a success. And they felt that their team desperately needed a political success. And also, you know, the recovery goals that were imposed upon the Federal Wildlife Service, because they had a tough job, and they did a good job of protecting the grizzly. You know, they didn't know about global warming. They didn't know we were going to have a massive, huge firestorm in 1988, and that global warming was going to decimate the grizzly bear's most important food, which is the nut of the White Bark Pine tree, which is functionally extinct in Yellowstone due to global warming. And all that happened about, it started in 2002 when the winter started to warm up, and by 2007, 90% plus of all the white bark, mature white bark pine trees were gone, and they're still gone, and they're not coming back in our lifetime. It's not the first time that the Interagency Grizzly Committee, the Federal Wildlife Service, has taken the grizzly bear of Yellowstone off the endangered species list. They did it back in 2007. And it's interesting because I know you're going to ask me about, you know, the Democratic activists, or they don't really call themselves Democrats much, in Montana. It's the same group of people that are fighting for the grizzly. It's the same knot of people leading the charge. And back in 2007, that's what happened. You know, we led the charge at public meetings, went out, and I emceed a talk down in Jackson, Wyoming. The next morning, we had a headline that said, don't delist the grizzly. And we also had the regional forest manager which attended that talk. And the next day, we had money of $250,000 to go study the white bark pine tree mortality. And that work went on for a couple of years. It was headed up by a couple of friends of mine and who are still in the neighborhood. My son actually worked on that study, but they did aerial photography because this was the first climate change that you could see from space. The tops of all the mountains turned red all the way around Yellowstone. And that red means that's the white bark pine zone. It's a five-needle pine, and it's high altitude. And you have to go to Siberia before you find another grizzly bear ecosystem so dependent upon these five-needle pine nuts. Earth Justice represented a bunch of environmental groups. They went to court, and in 2009, a federal judge in Missoula sided with the environmentalists because of their disregard of white bark pine nuts and their disbelief that climate change is having any effects, especially ill effects, upon the grizzly population. And so the bear was put back on the endangered species list, and now it's happening all over again. I would say that the issues are pretty much the same with the exception of turning management over to the states and the hunting season. The hunting season, the trophy hunting season, is what's new if the bear succeeds in being delisted.
These would be bears that leave Yellowstone Park and go into off the borders into either Wyoming, Idaho, or Montana? Is that how it's going to work?
Oh, yeah, but Yellowstone's not that big a place. It's a couple million acres. But grizzly bears travel enormous distances. You know, males have a huge home range, sometimes 100 square miles. Grizzly bears overnight can travel 48 miles and make beeline runs. Mothers with cubs tend to be a little more local. But Yellowstone isn't big enough to hold. Most grizzlies in Yellowstone leave the park at one time or another. All of those beautiful roadside bears everybody takes pictures of and turns into beautiful photography books, those things can be hunted. You know, if it gets turned over to the state of Wyoming, those beautiful bears, like the famous grizzly bear down in Pilgrim Creek, can be shot. And actually, an outfitter has promised to go out and target that particular mother bear that Tom Mangelson made into a beautiful book.
You wrote an article that can be read on roundriver.org in which you talk about having gone recently with your daughter to the northern border of Yellowstone Park and having an encounter with a mother grizzly bear and her cub. Say what happened.
Well, I took my daughter to a beautiful little hilltop in Yellowstone. It's a steep-sided hillside, and that was just a month ago. And my daughter's getting married this summer, so it was our last Yellowstone hike before the wedding. And the wind was blowing like crazy, so we were huddling behind a giant rock. And I looked at my daughter, and I saw her face change. And then looking past her, 40 feet away was a mother grizzly and her yearling cub. We all saw each other at the same moment. The grizzly bear reared, you know, stood up and looked around and smelled around, trying to tell what we were because she could see us but not smell us. And anyway, over the next couple minutes, she decided, because we didn't move a muscle, I said, Laurel, don't move a muscle, or don't move, or something like that. And the bear decided that we were not a threat at all. And she proceeded to walk right up, not right up, but past us, and stop on the edge of this cliff and nurse her young for 7 minutes, just 35 feet away. It was incredible. This has happened to me at salmon streams in Alaska and British Columbia, you know, where a mother grizzly might bring her cubs over and leave them with you and then go get a salmon and come back, because those mother bears have learned that human beings keep big male grizzlies from coming over and threatening their cubs. And while this grizzly, you know, my daughter and I were 30 feet away, and she's nursing her cub, her yearling cub, and it's an incredible sound, the puttering sound they make. I heard the vocalizations, kind of a bellow of two other adult grizzlies. And in June, that means a mating pair. And one of those, of course, was a big dominant male grizz. And it was a choice. We were the safer option, you know, trust Doug and Laurel rather than the big male grizzly. And that's never happened to me in Yellowstone Park before. It was magic.
Well, it's magic just hearing about it. Okay, we only have 1 minute left, and I really mean 1 minute, for your comments on the Montana politics and our congressional delegation. Go for it.
Well, we had a special election, and it was pretty special because it was a real grassroots effort. People were watching us from way over. It was Rob Quist versus Gianforte, a billionaire that you mentioned before, who, you know, the eve of the election assaulted some poor reporter from The Guardian. We think we could have turned that election. And the National Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee just decided Montana wasn't worth dumping any money in. And so the billionaire bought the election, not easily. We closed a lot of points. You know, Trump won for Montana, and we closed about 20 points on Trump, as I remember. But Rob Quist lost, and we, you know, we felt a real surge here, and we still do. You know, the same people that went out to support Rob Quist are also helping myself and Nurse Justice and others fight the Yellowstone delisting. So it's almost, it's more of a tribal entity than anything else. We're excited about Montana and our progressive activism, and we hope all Democrats will lend a hand next time, especially the national committees.
Thank you so much for joining us on Forthright Radio today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Joy.
Our guests today on Forthright Radio have been, in our first segment, Julian Brave Noisecat, whose work can be seen at julianbravenoisecat.com. We barely scratched the surface of it, and we spoke most recently with Doug Peacock. You can find out more about his work at dougpeacock.net. And of course, the views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KZYX and Z's staff, its members, or board of directors or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production, broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson. I'm Joy LeClaire. You can contact us by emailing forthrightradio@gmail.com.